It's with real pleasure, brethren and sisters, young people and friends, that on this last evening that we can share together and that we can have our brother Frank here to deliver us the words this evening to the title, as you have it upon your screen there, on the Dead Sea Scrolls, the greatest archaeological discovery of all time. And I'll call up brother Frank to give us something exciting. Thank you, brother Frank.
Well, brothers and sisters and young people and friends, this study is one of a few, but a number, of studies that are addressing prophecy at a little different level. It's like as if there was a labyrinth of studies that only people who know their Bibles could understand and see the significance of it. The present study we're going to look at tonight, the Dead Sea Scrolls, is one of them. But just to give you a little idea of what the others might be, the Bible speaks of some things, and it says it will never happen. And then it says other things that must happen. And if our eyes are open and we're looking in the world that we presently live in, we will see evidences of that happening all the time, which is like seeing the fingerprint of God upon the events that are in the world. We can't always make that out. We see what God tells us, and we see how things are sort of moving along in that direction. But this is different. This is looking at things that have happened and seeing the fingerprint of God upon it. For instance, you may remember that the Bible says Babylon would never be rebuilt. And not so long ago, a man came along with the desire to rebuild Babylon. His name was Saddam Hussein. And if you followed the life and the events of that man, you will know that he went a long way to try to build Babylon or rebuild the old city. He had bricks made that were just like Nebuchadnezzar's bricks, but it was his name on it. He had signs and billboards painted where he had Nebuchadnezzar on one side and him on the other side. And sort of like he was the modern Nebuchadnezzar. He was going to rebuild Babylon with all the glory and all the fame and with the purpose of destroying Jerusalem, taking the Jews out of Jerusalem. So he must have known a little bit about the Bible because of what he wanted to do. But you know what happened to him. I tell you, put that study together and just look at the events that took place and how long it was before it took place and how it was that finally he made a few mistakes that brought the world against him. And Babylon was not rebuilt. The Bible was vindicated. That city would not be rebuilt. And so Bible students, people who knew their Bible, could see this. And they could thrill to the fact, you know, God's alive and he will not let people do things that he said would never be done. And then more recently, you know how we've been studying, as we did in our studies, the book of Revelation, in particular the 16th chapter and the sixth vial. And we know how it says that there would be frog-like spirits. And you may know how it helps Israel talks about these frog characters on the shield of one of the kings of France, one of the early kings of France. And you know that we are therefore looking for these frog-like spirits that are in the world. Well, we went through all of the Arab Spring nations and events that took place in northern Africa. And all of those nations that was going through were all members of the Ottoman Empire. And just in a couple years ago, we were seeing an event or events taking place in this sixth vial that just reminded us of what was happening, that this is the sixth vial period. People didn't know their Bible, never saw a thing. But people who knew their Bible, and if they were listening to the news, and they could hear that when Egypt, for instance, and it was going under that time period when they were trying to overthrow their president, and you would hear someone yell out something, you know, in Egyptian. And then you'd hear all the other people yelling it out and yelling it out. Well, all you have to do is live on a farm. And if you lived on a farm and you lived by a pond and you had a few frogs around, that's how frogs communicate. One frog, you know, and all the others, croak, croak, on the other side of the pond. And that frog-like behavior, which we were watching because we knew this was the French frog-like spirits, was actually being imitated on the radio for anybody who could recognize it. Well, not many people did recognize it. But those who had their Bibles open welcomed it, because this was just further confirmation of what was happening in the world was what the Bible had said. Just a little event, but an event that gave us, again, the footprints of our God. And I think this is another one. This is old. No, these things were found and discovered largely in 1947 through to 1956. Oh, it's 50 years ago, longer than 50 years ago. So why would we be making some point of this now? Well, because there's a real significant, at least 2 points, that Bible students, I think, need to know. Because in this day when people are trying to put down our Bible, we really need everything we can see to illustrate that this Bible is relevant. I mean, it really is kind of odd that anyone would say that you could pick up this book and say, well, here's a prophecy that was written 2,500 years ago that has relevance today. Well, people might say there's some oblique reference, some very, you know, hard to make out, possibly detail. But no, that's not what we're saying. We're saying God's working with a nation. And he's telling us and has told us through a prophecy written that long ago what would happen in these days. This is no ordinary book. It's a literary miracle. Like, there's no other book around anywhere that competes with this. In that category, this book is the only book on the shelf. Well, that's the way we've got to see it. And what we're dealing with tonight is the people who said the Bible couldn't possibly be right because it's being copied. And they say, if you want to see what I mean, just take out a page of paper, you know, write out a sentence or two, and then, you know, tell someone else what you wrote and let them write what they thought they heard. And the time you get around the room, just see how it looks at the end. And we've done that. We've played that game. And it doesn't look anything like it started with. So they say, how could you expect that animal skins and the papyrus could possibly contain things today that were relevant to the truth that was originally given? And so what do we say? Well, we believe it is. We think that things that are happening as God predicted, but the real truth came with this discovery, because they discovered very old scrolls. So old that they were 1,000 years older than anything that people had to the time. 1,000 years older than any scrolls they had that are of Hebrew origin. They found them in those caves. Well, what would you like to do if you found those scrolls? Would you like to answer these people? Is this original scroll something like what we have in our Bible today? Or is it at odds with what we have in the Bible today? And how did they find it? And what's the significance of the time when they found it? Those are the things which people miss. You see, when you looked at the scrolls, we found this. There's 11 caves that they found them in. There was 19,000 fragments, little bits and pieces, in some cases, of scrolls that were so old, they just found these little pieces. There were 800 different scrolls, but only 200 of them were biblical. And most people make the most out of the 600 scrolls that were not biblical. We're not interested in them tonight. We're interested in the ones that were biblical, because we want to see how they compared with our Bible that we have presently. They were made on 4 materials: the skin of animals, papyrus, copper, and lead. There was 4 languages: ancient Hebrew, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. They were discovered between 1947 and 1956, and they were dated as being between 1900 and 2200 years ago. That's when they were written. So you see, if we have a prophecy that's 2500 years ago, and we have an actual scroll around that contains that prophecy, which is 2200 years old, that's pretty significant. That's 1,000 years older than anything anybody had prior to finding those scrolls. And it contained primary information. Isaiah 43 is significant. In fact, anything you can make out of Isaiah is significant, because that was the only scroll out of all 200 that was intact. Everything was there. One Isaiah scroll. They found every book of the Old Testament, that is, bits of it, except Esther. So it gives you a little framework. But what we're interested in is this, that in Isaiah 43, verses 9 and 10, it says, "Let all the nations be gathered together, let the people be assembled. Who among them can declare this and show us former things? Let them bring forth their witnesses, that they may be justified, or let them hear and say, it is truth." Well, what other nation can do this? Could Australia do this? Could Canada do this? Could the United States do this? No, there's only one people. And God calls them, "You are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant whom I have chosen, that you may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God formed, neither shall there be after me." So it's Israel and Israel's God that's brought to the forefront by this study and by the scroll of Isaiah. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to Israel, but in 2004, when we went to Israel, it was a pretty rough year with some of the things that were happening around the city. And in Jerusalem, that was our welcoming crew. First of all, two army officers met you when you came to the door, and they asked you, what's your mission? Every time we came back to the hotel, what's your mission? What are you doing? Just because they're army men, and they're told what they have to do. When you satisfied them, you went to these two individuals in the middle. They were at the door. They had to look at every parcel you brought in, no matter how many times you came to the hotel. That's Israel, but it was Israel 10 years ago. When you walk around Israel, you have to be a little careful if you're walking by yourself, because this is a common sight. Danger. Mines. It was on the fence between the area of Israel and the area of Bethlehem, but it was also found, at least we found it, in the northern part when we were walking up and around the Sea of Galilee. When we went to Hebron back in 2004, that's Brother Paul Billington, as you may recognize him, we had to go in an armored vehicle. It was the only safe vehicle that they could take us in at that time. So when you went in that door, you went into a little containment part of the van, which they closed, and you were really in a bulletproof part of the van. Quite exciting, actually. When we went into the city of Jerusalem, this is a rose garden. It's in Jerusalem. I'll show you a little bit more about that in a later slide. But off to your left would be the Knesset building, the parliament building for Israel. So this is right in that part of Jerusalem. But what I wanted to draw your attention to is this building right here, because that's the shrine of the book. And that's how close it is to the parliament and how close it is to this very, very beautiful garden. What impressed me so much about this garden was the scent of the trees. And that's something, you know, when you look at trees and you look at flowers, quite often you just see the beauty of it. But to go and to smell the scent and the aroma of various trees that were growing in that garden was something I had never experienced in my life. Now, Israel is a land of caves. There's holes in the rock everywhere. Wonderful thing for young people to go and just imagine what's behind that hole. What's living in there? And you can see that some of these look like they've been carved out. They don't look like they're just made, you know, naturally, that someone actually carved that. So who's living in those holes? And when we read our Bible, it comes alive, because we know that there were times when the people of Israel fled to caves and they lived in those caves. When David and his men were in a cave. Well, there was a lot of caves in Israel. And even in 100 BCE, that is the time when we believe that the scrolls were put in the jars that were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it wasn't a new idea, because you know that in Jeremiah 32, verses 13 and 14, it says, "And I charged Barak before them, saying, Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, take these evidences, this evidence of the purchase, both which is sealed and this evidence which is open, and put them in an earthen vessel that they may continue many days. And no, we've wondered, will they ever find this? When Jeremiah is resurrected, would he be able to go and actually find this paper? So putting something in a jar seems to have been well established, that that's the way they would preserve things and maybe even hide things. Now, this is an important slide because I want you to understand that what I'm saying tonight is not my take on this. This is where I got this from. If I hadn't read these two books, I wouldn't be here speaking on this tonight. Because this man, Yigal-Yadin, was the chief man doing all the archaeological explorations at the time of the scrolls. And he was the author of both of these books. These books would be written or available on Amazon, used books. And if you just take a note of the author and the title, this one would be Qumran, the scrolls at Qumran, and this is the scroll at Masada. Both of those places are of interest tonight to us. Well, the scrolls didn't look that good, but what would you expect for something that was 2,000 years old? Like, people didn't believe there were any scrolls like this. They didn't believe that animal skins could survive in that climate for 2,000 years. And so when they were initially found, there was a lot of skepticism that this was a fake. Somebody's trying to get us to pay money that is for it's fraudulent in the way they were going about it. So you can see these scrolls. They really were old. They were rotted, they were decayed, they were spoiled on various parts, but there was enough writing on them in order to understand where they came from. Now in Israel, in the Shrine of the Book, when you go in this large building, you see a cylinder that's nicely illuminated, quite dark in the building, but that part's illuminated, to give you the idea that you're going into a cave. And spread out around the cylinder is the whole scroll of Isaiah, a copy, not the original, but on animal skins. Now, these animal skins, the scroll would have been about that high, about 17 feet long, stitched together with little panels, which would be about as wide as the page on your Bible. They were just animal skins stitched together, and they were written on with ink. You can see the ink there. You can see, for instance, where they were stitched. You can maybe see a little stitching down here. You can see that there was a tear here and someone had to stitch it up. You can see there's little comments made on the text on the way through. So this was the condition of the Isaiah scroll. And that would be pretty hard to fake. But if someone wanted $1 million for this, they might even invest the time to make it look that well. So when they were initially seen, the people were not sure whether they were authentic or not. Now, those are the two sites. Okay, so Qumran is up at the top of the Dead Sea, and Masada down the bottom of the Dead Sea, as the Dead Sea presently is. So the bottom part down here is pretty well dried up. Dead Sea is quite a place. I did see some of the shoreline that looked like that, covered in salt. Saltiest place you can imagine. It's just really quite an interesting feeling to have when you're going down from Jerusalem down to Jericho and you see partway down a sign that says sea level. And you get an idea of how much of that whole area would all be underwater if the sea could flood in. And you go down and down and down and down and down until you come to these old cities that we've recognized in our Bible, the city of Jericho, and then some of the excavations and older cities at that place. And yeah, I even tried that. That's not me, incidentally, but I did try it to see that, yeah, that Dead Sea is so salty that you can float if you're on your back, but it would be not a good idea to try to turn over. If you turn over, the likelihood is your face or your eyes will get in that water, and that will sting like no water you've ever been in. But it's quite a feeling, the buoyancy of the Dead Sea water. Now, it's a rugged landscape. I mean, it's beautiful in its ruggedness. That's the cliffs from where you are, more up into the Jerusalem area at the top here, and then way down to the Dead Sea. You can see the little road at the bottom. You might even be able to spot a car or two on it to give you the idea of it. And the interesting thing is, when you look at it, you'll notice that there's what they call wadis, or valleys, where water actually has run not so long ago down there at such a rate, it washed the whole road out. So that occasionally they do have rain, but the rain is just seems to run off the soil, and it comes down really as a torrent into the Dead Sea. Now, the section that we want to first look at is this place called Qumran. And it's, if you were in up to Jerusalem, you would come down this road. You come down to this road. This goes off to Jericho, and this goes down to Eilat. So there's this little place off in this area. A little better look at it in this slide, where you can see this is what the Israelis made as the access point. There's your parking lot. There's a lovely building here to be able to illustrate some of the things that they do about the Dead Sea area. Excuse me, the Dead Sea Scrolls in the area. And then you'll notice a couple little black or little white spots here. These are the roofs of shelters that are made so you can look across here, because our first slide was about that point right there. And that was where there were a lot of pieces of the scrolls found. There it is. 15,000 of the 19,000 pieces were found in that cave complex. Inside the cave, if you were to actually look in that window, you would notice that someone had actually channeled out the rock on this side and in places on this side as well. And it looked like they must have run either boards or something across to make shelves. This appears to have been a library where there were jars stuffed with rolls, probably laid on their side and just together along the shelf. And what they think happened was that the Romans discovered this place and went in there with their swords and their weapons and just smashed everything to bits, so that they didn't find whole scrolls. They just found fragments of scrolls, thousands of them. But recognizing how precious these would be, they were retrieved little piece by little piece. Well, there's a little section away with us. We're down in that area filming. And what we wanted to see, probably most of all, was in this part of the work, was the evidence that a goat would ever be in that area. Like, people talk about the way the story goes, that some young lad was coming through this area. He was chasing his goats. He thought maybe the goats had climbed up into a cave. I'll show you the cave in a minute. And in order to try to flush the goat out, he took a stone and he threw it right through the hole of the cave, and he heard something smash. But he was after the goats, so they just recorded that and then ran off after the goats. The next day he came back, they went into the cave to find out what was in there, and that's when they discovered the jars. These jars had been sitting in the cave's mouth with the door wide open for 2,000 years. Nobody had gone in to retrieve them. They had never suffered any loss by weather. And it was just an amazing thing that anybody could do this so accidentally, but such a long time after they were put in there. Well, there's lots of these little goats. The little ibex, they were all over the place. Even though you couldn't see much to eat, they knew where they were going to eat. And so, yeah, they would be running fast, probably by something that wasn't attractive to them at all. So let's go back to this cave, the cave of the greatest discovery. So it's on the northwest shoreline of the Dead Sea, and that's what it looks like. And that's probably why you don't see it placarded on posters and see it very often in any display in the Dead Sea, because it just doesn't look too attractive. In fact, it might be something you wouldn't even want to walk around. But in the front of these caves, in here and here, were openings. And that was where the young lad threw the stone to try to get the goats out. Well, this is cave one. And in cave one, there were seven scrolls found. A scroll of Isaiah called Isaiah 1A, another scroll of Isaiah called Isaiah B, and then these five other scrolls which were non-biblical. By non-biblical, I mean they weren't parts of the Bible. They might have been about the Bible, but they weren't the Bible itself. So the Habakkuk commentary, the Thanksgiving scroll, the Manual of Discipline, the War Rule, the Genesis Apocryphon were all books. And you see, the Israelis were primarily interested in that. They didn't seem to be too interested in the Bible. I found going into their shrine of the book a real disappointment. Because what I thought they would do is you go in there and they say, look, we found the scroll of Isaiah. And look what the scroll of Isaiah says about Israel. Not a comment about it. But about these other scrolls, about what they found and what they thought about the people who hid them and the people who actually had these libraries, well, there was a whole lot of things they made of that. So a Bible student would probably be disappointed going into the shrine of the book. Now, that's the man Yigal-Yadin. Looks a bit like a tough man, doesn't he? He was chief of the military for a while. He was a man high in government. He was a professor. He was the chief archaeological man on the site. And he really, in his writing, he's read an interesting writer. Any of his books that you get, you, I think, would find them quite interesting to read. Yigal-Yadin. Now, I want you to hear what he said. Okay, so this man has a Jewish background. He doesn't seem to be anything other than just Jewish in his sort of religious outlook. But he's a smart man, and this is what he had to say. He says, I cannot avoid the feeling there's something symbolic about the discovery of the scrolls and their acquisition at the moment of the creation of the state of Israel. It is as if these manuscripts had been waiting in caves for 2,000 years ever since the destruction of Israel's independence, until the people of Israel had returned to their home and regained their freedom. This symbolism is heightened by the fact that the first three scrolls were bought by my father for Israel on the 29th of November 1947, the very day on which the United Nations voted for the recreation of the Jewish state in Israel after 2,000 years. That's the closest I could see in any of his writing to recognize just what a find this was. Now think of it, brothers and sisters, young people. Think of it. Think of the significance of this. The Jewish people had been in dispersion, in captivity, scattered around the world for 2,000 years. We make, as Christadelphians, a lot out of their regathering to the place that they originally occupied in Israel, that they called it the State of Israel. But we've made very little of the fact that there was some significance to November 29th. Oh, some of the older brethren and sisters who were alive at that time, they knew how the Christadelphian community rejoiced to see that Israel was finally on the way to becoming a state again. That was November the 29th. But not anybody that I know of recorded the fact that on that very night, when the world did something that they have never done since, don't want any part of since, they did something that established or led to the establishment of the State of Israel. And they also had a copy of the scroll that said that would happen after 2,000 years laying in a cave. Oh, you could say it's coincidence, but look at this is the way our God works, brothers and sisters. In Exodus 12, verses 40 to 41, the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day, it came to pass that all the hosts of Yahweh went out from the land of Egypt. Do you think God cares about days? Well, he certainly does. That's just one case in the Bible where God does something significantly on a particular day. So when we go back and look at this man's statement, that you know, he can't quite figure it out, but there's a feeling that something symbolic about this discovery of the scrolls. I think the Christadelphians need to respond and reply to that. We'll tell you what the symbolism is. Yes, God's at work. And he's bringing his people back to the land, establishing them as a state again. And that was one of the greatest things about it in 1947. You know, 1947 was an interesting year. Can you imagine? The city of Jerusalem is divided between Israel and, or at least between the Israelis, or the Jews, I guess at that time, he didn't have the state called Israel then, and the Arabs. And there was barbed wire down the middle of the street. And this antiquities dealer didn't know when he took the scrolls to them, he didn't know what these things were. He didn't believe that any of these scrolls could be authentic. He wasn't about to buy scrolls that were fake. So he thought, I got to get this checked out. So he went to a Jewish professor who actually was the father of Yigal Yadin. Because you can see, he says, the first three scrolls were bought by my father. So the antiquities dealer took them to the barbed wire and he showed him a little piece of these scrolls. And the Jewish professor picked the scroll up. He couldn't make this out. This was Hebrew he hadn't seen or couldn't recognize immediately. So he said, well, I better have a better look at these things. You want to loan them to me? Three scrolls, loan them to him. Can you imagine the Arabs loaning anything to Israelis? Yeah, you loan the three scrolls to him. And he said, well, I need to look at these and I'll get them back to you. So they sort of just made a verbal agreement. No lawyers involved. There's no paperwork involved. And this Israeli professor took them to his room and he's looked at these things and he says he couldn't believe that anything like this could be that old. And yet the ancient Hebrew script was so beautifully written, this wasn't a fake in his mind. So he thought he'd check this out with some of his colleagues, but it was a weekend. All his colleagues were away. He couldn't check it out with anybody. So he had to make a decision, because otherwise you have to give this back to the Arabs and he might never see it again. So he went to the bank and he mortgaged his house for £1,500. And he went and he offered it to the antiquities dealer, £1,500 for the first three scrolls. It was a deal, across barbed wire. And he got the scrolls. That's what it means, that he purchased the scrolls on that very day for Israel, under those circumstances. Oh, this was pretty high drama. So what do you think? Coincidence or prophecy being fulfilled? A scroll of Isaiah was placed in a jar in this cave sometime while the land of Israel was being destroyed by the Roman armies. 2,000 years passed without the scroll being discovered or disturbed, even though the door was open, even though it wasn't far from the level of the Dead Sea, even though it was exposed to the elements. 2,000 years. Then, while one of the main prophecies in the scroll was being fulfilled, Israel coming back to the land, it was rediscovered in that very year, 1947. In fact, the very night. That's our God. Now, many people would never see it. They don't know their Bible well enough to connect the things. But when you're thinking of this, and you're thinking of how these things were connected, I think that's my conclusion. This is evidence of the touch of the divine hand. So the Shrine of the Book, if you just make this out to be the Israeli Knesset building, that's the parliament buildings. This is the garden that we are in the first slide, or the first couple slides there, where there's a garden, and we're looking across to the Shrine of the Book. This is the museum complex down here, a wonderful place. And I tell you, I just noticed this recently on the internet, that all of the exhibits in this complex are now on the web. That you can actually view all of these exhibits. Go through it yourself in your own leisure, in your own home, and look at what they have in the museums in Israel. And they have a lot of other things that relate to discoveries that go back into the period of the Bible. Well, how about those other four scrolls? Now, this is another interesting little aspect to the story. What the Arabs did was they took them to America. If you want to get more money, go to America. And what the Americans did when they got the scrolls, they copied them, put them in their files, and said, we don't need them anymore. I mean, it's just amazing how people act on that part. But Yigal Yadin, several years later, was lecturing in New York. And he was lecturing on what they had discovered about those first three scrolls when someone brought it to his attention that there was something that would really be very interesting to him. And it's displayed in this building. Now, just before I get there, I want to just illustrate to you how neat the architecture of the Shrine of the Book is. Because you see, this here is like the top of the of all the containers, the jars in which the scrolls were found. That's what the top looked like. And this is just a plain black wall. And that's how visible they were. If you had the wall in between you, you couldn't see them. But all you had to do was just get in front of the cave, and the access to them was immediately obvious. I thought that was quite nicely done. But look at this. This ad appeared in the Wall Street Journal in New York. And it says, 4 Dead Sea Scrolls, Bible manuscripts dating back to at least 200 BC are for sale. This would be an ideal gift to an educational or religious institution by an individual or group. Box F, 206, the Wall Street Journal. And someone brought that to the attention of Galliadin and said, I know where your 4 scrolls are. And here they are. Well, if you can read this down here, well, I can't read it quite where I am, but I can see it now. The scrolls belonging to the Syrian Orthodox Church are put up for sale in New York. Professor Galliadin purchases the scrolls on behalf of the State of Israel for $250,000. He paid a lot more for the next 4 than he did the first 3. But now those scrolls are reckoned to be next to being priceless, because now they see what they are and their full value. Both of them were bargains. Now, this is where it gets valuable to us, because you see, we still haven't answered the question. The question is, people were saying this is an unreliable book, because if it was originally written 2,500 years ago, it might have had to be copied within 50 years and recopied within 50 years. And it would have went so many copies that by the time we got our copy now, there would be just all kinds of errors in it. So what did they find? Well, this is his words. They're in that book, the Isaiah Scrolls, that I quoted to you. Thus we know that even from this second source, the Septuagint, we have not full text of the Bible earlier than the 4th century A.D. In the light of that fact, it is easy to appreciate the great importance of 2 Isaiah texts discovered among the Qumran scrolls. These texts are about 1,000 years older than the oldest Hebrew text known to us, and about 500 years older than the earliest Greek version of the Septuagint. Now, just remember, brothers and sisters and young people, that's not my words. I'm not telling you this, making the number up. That's what this Jewish professor said. This is 1,000 years older than anything we had. Let's have a look at it. What is astonishing, he said, is that despite their antiquity and the fact that the scrolls belong to this pre-standardization period, they are on the whole almost identical with the Masoretic text known to us. This establishes a basic principle for all future research on texts of the Bible. Not even the hundreds of slight variations established in the text, affecting mainly spelling and occasional word substitution, can alter that fact. Now you get an answer. The next time someone says to you, oh, I can't believe that anybody could copy this accurately and that our present text is anything like the original text, well, just quote this to them. That when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls and they looked at them and they analyzed them, compared to what they have now, this Masoretic text, there was only a few variations associated mainly with spelling and occasional word substitution. Otherwise, it's what we've got. I think that is sensational. Because you see, it establishes for us that the Bible is accurate. It is what God gave. If this text is that old, as they say it is, 2,200 years old, it's quite possible that that text would have been available to Jesus. He did read from the Isaiah text in Isaiah chapter 61, and this is an example of what he could have read. Hardly any different at all from what we read today. As far as the skeptics are concerned, we might have expected they would have something to say. Well, they did. And this was an article I got out of the Toronto Daily Star, 2006. And it said, the Chinese connection. Now, I don't know if you can read that there, but I'll just try to bring that up. New discoveries from Asia suggest the Dead Sea Scrolls may not be as old as we think. It had to occur. The skeptics had to say something in return. And so they said, these little funny marks that we see on the edges of the Isaiah scroll indicate that it had some Chinese connection. Well, Chinese letters are quite interesting to follow and to see what they're on, but that could be just scribble. They didn't recognize any language. They couldn't read it. But they were obliged, it seems, to say something. And I put this quote on. Beloved, believe not every spirit. Try the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. And when they say in their headline that they may not be as old as we think, let's just continue on in our investigation here. This I got out of a little video that I saw at a kiosk in the area of Qumran. And it mentions what people, or what the scholars were saying, or at least the Jewish people that were there, were saying about those scrolls. Now just notice this. It says, today, scholarly opinion regarding the time span and background of the Dead Sea Scrolls is anchored in historical, paleographic, linguistic evidence corroborated firmly by carbon 14 datings. Some manuscripts were written and copied in the 3rd century BCE, that's before Christ, but the bulk of the material, particularly the texts that reflect on a sectarian community, are originals or copies from the 1st century BCE. Now that's what the scientists have to say. So if they say, well, you know, you're just Bible students and you already don't know the science of it, that's what scientists were saying. That this whole idea of the scholarly opinion regarding the time span and background of the Dead Sea Scrolls is anchored in all that science wants to see. Historical, paleographic, linguistic evidence, and corroborated by carbon 14 datings. But that's not all, because look at this. Now, this is one of the things that I think that God does, that you sort of look at these things as to why it took the time it did for them to be discovered. So they say there's 3 technologies that were needed to develop in the 1980s to be able to assist in the analysis of the scrolls. One of them, infrared technology, permitted the reading and copying of the scroll content. And the man demonstrated this. He had a number of little scroll fragments out on a desk, and you could just see them. They just looked like pieces of old paper. But then he illuminated them with infrared light, and suddenly there was writing all over them. So without the infrared technology, they wouldn't have been able to see or copy the scroll content. The DNA analysis permitted scientists to piece together which fragment came from which scroll. Now the man said this. He said, go down to the store and buy yourself 3 big packages of potato chips and make sure they're different colors. And when you get them home, before you open them up, just scrunch them all up so they're all in little bits. He says, pour them out into a bowl, mix them all up, and throw them over the floor. Then pick them up, and put them back together again. That is back in the original chip, never mind bags. Anybody want to do that tonight? I don't think so. Well, with DNA analysis, they could analyze these little pieces. And because each animal had a different DNA, they could tell which pieces belonged to which animal. And if they could determine the animal, they could put these things in categories where most of the pieces on a common animal would probably be also on the same text, the same scroll. Clever. But not available until DNA analysis was also available to the scientists involved. Carbon 14 dating was used to provide proof of the age of the scrolls. And so when people say, well, you know, there could have been something, some Chinese connection that maybe they were planted in there from someplace and they're not nearly that old, No. You want science? Carbon 14 dating says that they were about 2,200 years old. Now I want to go down to Masada just to finish this off. If you've been at Masada, it is a magnificent place. Sister Dorothy and I went down there for our 40th anniversary. We just went driving around Israel. And we went down to Masada just to see what people had said was there. So we didn't take this trip. Like, I didn't go by air. But I'm glad for the picture because it really does show the idea of Masada. What is the distinguishing feature is this white ramp. And that's historical. That's a 2,000-year-old feature of Masada, which tells an incredible story of what happened there. Because this goes back to the events that I'm going to talk about A.D. 71 to maybe A.D. 73, 74, just in the time of the few years after the sacking of Jerusalem by the Romans. How do they know that? Well, one of the things they found was they found coins that were minted in those years at Masada. So they found it was probably the years in which the Zealots were there. Now, originally, Masada was a palace. The Herod who built the temple in Jerusalem also had a palace in Masada, in a very wonderful place. So you get a tremendous view of the whole area from Masada. But when he came, or at least after the sacking of Jerusalem and the Zealots had come down here, they had somehow managed to get the Romans out of this place and taken it over. And General Silva of the Roman army knew that the Jews would be back to Jerusalem if we didn't get them out of Masada. So they came down to get these Zealots that were on this hill. And when he got there, the first thing he did was he made a wall, a containing wall, just to what could be guarded by sentries so that they could just keep these Zealots in that area. And then they made these things. Now, you might not be able to spot that from where you're seated, but that is a Roman encampment. And there's a couple other ones. There's another Roman encampment there. These are little features of the landscape that look like they've been made, man-made. And so the Romans came down. They had several thousand slaves with them. They had the Roman troops with them. And the idea was, we got to get the Zealots off the top of this hill. So what they did with their labor, they made this ramp, him and labor. I guess it was buckets after buckets. And they built it up and built it up so they could get a track on this and a siege engine. Now, the only way I have an idea that's what they did is because they have a display there that illustrates that there was a siege engine and a track on this. So they put they pushed the siege engine up to the walls. They battered the wall and they got a hole through it in no time at all because that wall was not made to withstand a battering ram. Who would ever think you would have a battering ram on a hill that big? That's quite a big hill when you get down there and you look up at it. But the Romans went back that night to their encampment. They didn't go in and take the place, even though they had a hole in it. And when they came back the next day, the Jewish Zealots had sealed the hole. And apparently they had sealed it with wood packed behind with sand, which actually made it stronger than it was before. That is, at least to withstand a battering ram. So the Romans decided they had either to build a new ramp, which could have taken months, or they had to burn it out. And they decided that they would at least give it a try to see if they could burn out this wood that was now bridging the gap in the wall. And this is reported by the historian Josephus. And he illustrated that they initially, because there's such a wind that blows up there, the wind usually coming up, the Romans felt that they could put a fire against this and they would actually burn the boards out. And eventually, they actually managed to do that. They got enough of a hole in it that they could put the battering ram back to work and put a hole in it, went back down for another night in their encampment. The next day they came up with a very different scene because the Zealots had decided they were done. Every man went back to his family, and it was his duty to kill his wife and his children. Then the men assembled together, and 13 of them were chosen by lot, to kill all the rest. And then one man was selected to kill the other 12. And the last man was to burn what he could and kill himself. When the Romans came up the next day, they were all dead. That's Masada. That's the history of the place. That's why the Israelis make so much of Masada, because of what those zealots did. This is quite a place. I would strongly suggest if you have a chance to visit Israel, you go down there. The Israelis have done quite a job in restoration. The black line in the wall illustrates that when they went to Masada, everything below the line is what they found. Everything above the line is what they have restored. And they restored the little bits of the plaster that Herod had put there. And the color. Like, this looks like a cave. Who wants to live in a cave? No, that's a palace. That's a cave made into a palace. This was a king, a very notable king. And he lavished himself with all the things that were needed for quite a life. No, it is a very beautiful view. On a day when you don't have such a haze, you can see the hills of Jordan and look a long way up the Dead Sea. Just a few more pictures of the Roman encampments from the wall. And if you get down at eye level, that would be about 6 feet. So the Romans made these stone walls about 6 feet all the way around, and then put guards on them so that the men could come in at night and rest without having to worry about the zealots. They've restored this one right at the cable car entry so that you can get up there. You can walk up if you're young enough. The young Israeli recruits for the armed forces have to walk up, but usually tourists take the little aerial car here. And there's another case of a restored Roman fort, as they think it looked. Now, this is what the Israelis make of it, and this is, again, in that book on Masada. It says, it is thanks to Ben-Yair and his comrades, they are the zealots I've been talking about, to their heroic stand, to their choice of death over slavery, to the burning of their humble chattels as a final act of defiance to the enemy, that they elevated Masada to an undying symbol of desperate courage, a symbol which has stirred hearts throughout the last 19 centuries. It is this which moved the scholars and laymen to make the ascent to Masada. It is this which moved the modern Hebrew poet to cry, Masada shall not fall again. It is this which has drawn the Jewish youth of our generation in their thousands to climb to its summit in a solemn pilgrimage. And it is this which brings the recruits of the armored units of the defense forces of modern Israel to swear the oath of allegiance on Masada's heights, Masada shall not fall again. And that's what they make of Masada. And they missed a very vital thing. But not Yigal Yadin. He was looking this place over. He came down here to find scrolls. And they did find some scrolls in this place. But there was nothing very sensational, so nothing was made of them. But he does document it in his book. That's the another look at Herod's palace. But then he came to this place. And since it was a little different angle than other buildings on the wall, they thought that this must have been a synagogue because it was facing Jerusalem. Now, it's an interesting character about Israelis. When they have an old scroll, they don't just burn it. They don't throw it out. They bury it. It would be like taking a body and you put it in a cemetery. Well, they put it in a geniza, which is like a cemetery for old scrolls. So if you probably all got your old Bibles. I don't think the Christadelphians would likely throw them out. You still got them. You know, your kids will inherit them. All these Bibles that Mom and Dad had and Grandpa had. You don't know what to do with old Bibles. Well, they thought they were buried there. So they went to investigate. And this is the geniza at Masada, because they found underneath the synagogue floor, which they excavated, a couple areas which looked like something had been disturbed. Well, they had to get the floor up. And that floor has been down for many, many centuries. But when they went and looked and started digging, they had to dig very, very carefully. You had no shovels. This is a teaspoon. This is a little toothbrush. You're picking and you're brushing, you're picking and you're brushing. And they got down to a point where they thought they saw something that was writing. So fine was this that it was hardly discernible. That's a picture of his book. That's right out of his book. And that's what he said they saw. Now you can make it out here. There's just a little bit of writing going across here. It just laid up over the remnants of some old earth or something. That's what you would find in a grave for scrolls. But what a find. Don't forget, they're digging in a grave, brothers and sisters. You find bones in a grave. You find examples of people who have died, who have had no hope. So the question was, what was on that scroll? And this is what was on the scroll. It was out of Ezekiel, and in particular, Ezekiel 37, which is the section on the valley of the dry bones. It said, "Then he said unto me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried, our hope is lost. We're cut off for our parts. Therefore prophesy and say unto them, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves. And I'll bring you into the land of Israel. And you shall know that I am Yahweh when I have opened your graves, O my people, and brought you out of your graves, and shall put my spirit in you, and you shall live, and I will place you in your own land. Then shall you know that I am Yahweh, that I, Yahweh, have spoken it and performed it, saith Yahweh." Well, I just think that is wonderful. They're digging in a grave. And they find a little piece of the Bible. Out of all the pages of the Bible they could find, they found in Ezekiel. And of all the pages of Ezekiel they could find, it's Ezekiel 37. And the part of Ezekiel 37 they found was, "I will open your graves and bring you out of your graves and bring you into the land of Israel." If the Jewish people don't want to make anything of this, then we do. Brothers and sisters, that's what we should be telling people. You don't find things like that under those circumstances without our God being at work. When people want to discount this book, we want to tell people of why it is God's word. And things like this just serve to show to us and prove to us that we're not on the wrong track. Young people, don't get off this track. Like, we're telling you things here tonight for the benefit of young people to take this up and to be able to show your generation that this book is reliable. And what God has said he will do, he will yet continue to perform. There will be a time when, because they're in their own land, they will recognize that God has done it and performed it. And then the nations of the world will come to take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew. In summary, we would say the Dead Sea Scrolls and their significance to Bible students is they illustrate the reliability of the biblical record. They underscore where we are in time according to God's plan. Like 2,000 years went by. Did God not know that the people wouldn't come back until that? No, these things were timed to be just right on. It's a message of hope to biblical students that God is living and that he is actually doing things and working out his word. So it gives us assurance, brothers and sisters and young people, that the other promises made in God's word will surely come to pass. And if we believe that, we're in good standing to go ahead until he comes. Thank you.